Now it's time for me to introduce our speaker this evening, Carrie A. She's from A Way Out in Tannersville, Pennsylvania. Please help me welcome Carrie.
Hi, my name is Carrie. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 6th, 1994. My home group is a Way Out Big Book Study Group in Tannersville, and my sponsor's name is Peggy. And whenever I give a talk, I always mention those three things because although it is God that has graced me with sanity and has removed my obsession for alcohol, it was these three things that helped me to get to God. You know, so I like to let you know that, you know, it's important to have these things. It's important to be in all three sides of the triangle. I mean, I think that if you're around Alcoholics Anonymous long enough, our life gets very busy when we get into doing all kinds of things. We get into living life. And that's really important, but it's also really important for me to stay grounded in Alcoholics Anonymous and be a good, active member of AA. you know, it's funny because I like to speak, in a sense, because I like to meet new people and I like to go to different groups and I like to get the opportunity to see how other AAs do things. And on the other hand, I really hate to speak. One, because I'm a natural liar. I want to make myself look a lot better than I am. And I can't do that from up here because that's not my job. My job is to stand here and to tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous works and to tell you why it works, how it works. And in a lot of ways, it's very difficult to talk about because looking at the spiritual experiences that I've had as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, they don't make sense to me. It seems to me absolutely insane that just doing these few simple things has changed my life so dramatically. I mean, I'm an alcoholic, which means I have a deadly disease. I have a disease in which has an abominable recovery rate. You know, and I'm sure if you ask around AA, you know, enough, and I'm sure you guys have heard statistics. People talk about statistics all the time, the relapse rate, the recovery rate in AA, you know. And, in the forward to the second edition, they talk about what the recovery rate of Alcoholics Anonymous was back when this book was, during the second edition, which I believe was 1955, but, you know, I'm not the AA historian, so I'm going to say it's 1950s, somewhere around there. Correct me later if I'm wrong. But the idea here is that it says that 50% of all people who were introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous sold their debt at once. Another 25 relapsed a couple times, came in, did the deal, and sobered up. And then the rest of the people improved. What does improved mean? It means that they were able to get periods of sobriety, which for an alcoholic is impossible. Because I have a disease that tells me that I need to drink no matter what. I have a disease that lies to me. I have a disease that tells me that I'm special, that nobody else has my experience. I have a disease that tells me that my problems are unique. And, of course, all of us are incredibly unique. We're all individuals. We all have our own personal histories. We all come into Alcoholics Anonymous with whatever we experienced before we got here, right? But this disease itself, the symptoms of the disease are relatively passe. You walk around and you're around AA enough, you hear things like, I always felt different. You hear things like, I'm incredibly insecure, I'm full of fear. You hear things like, once I start drinking, I can't control how much I drink. I have a mind that says it's a good idea to drink. And these things are really commonplace, and you hear in every AA meeting, if you're in a good meeting, that is. But in every AA meeting, you're going to hear these things, because those are the symptoms of what it means to be an alcoholic. And how those symptoms express themselves in us is the individual part of it. But there are some broad strokes that one can make to qualify one as being an alcoholic. I mean, I have a physical allergy, a mental obsession, and a spiritual malady. Now, I got sober at 18, so my drinking story is interesting. It's short, which I like. I'm actually pretty happy about that. Because I think if it was any longer, I wouldn't be here. I'm not gonna belabor it. I'm gonna give you a little bit because if there's anybody who's new to Alcoholics Anonymous or somebody who doesn't know if they're an alcoholic, and I describe what it looks like to be an alcoholic, I might help you today. So here's what happened. Is basically I grew up in a Irish Catholic household. Now I'm not blaming anything on anybody. I'm an alcoholic because I'm an alcoholic. I stopped wondering why. I mean, I remember for the first couple of years of being in AA, I used to wonder, like, well, I'm an alcoholic, but how did I get here? Why am I an alcoholic? And at this point, I'm like, I don't care. Can't drink. I got to go to AA. I got to be of service. These are wonderful things. I have a great life. And I get to do things that normal people don't get to do. I'm good with it. I don't even wonder why I'm an alcoholic anymore. I'm okay with it. But here's the thing. As I grew up in a household, my parents were adult children of alcoholics. They are not alcoholics. I'm one of five children. Four of us have darkened the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of us has not. She says things like, you know, she has a glass of wine and says that I'm sleepy. She calls, you know, wine a nightcap. I was like, I think I was like 10 years sober. I went on a cruise with my two older sisters. Being locked in the cabin for a week in the ocean with your two older sisters is an adventure in itself. Principles of the program really helped me from getting, you know, being tossed overboard and things like that. But, you know, my sister had a bottle of wine on the night table, and she's like, is this going to bother you? And I'm like, absolutely not, because alcohol doesn't have power over me today. I'm safe and protected. Do what you want to do. Bop till you drop, man. Now, I cleaned up some vomit, yes, but I was okay with that. They cleaned up enough of mine. But the thing was, is that one sister who's not an alcoholic would drink half a glass of wine and go to bed. And I have a very different reaction to alcohol than she does. I remember being in gym class, and I they had, like, you know, drug and alcohol awareness stuff, the mad dare crap that they do. They think they can scare alcoholics into not drinking, which is, if my own experience doesn't scare me, whatever you have to say really doesn't. So they would say things like, you know, alcohol is a central nervous system depressant. And I'm like, I'm in seventh grade. I'm drinking. I'm drinking on a pretty regular basis. And I'm thinking, no, it's not. I drink alcohol and I'm up. I'm ready to go out. I'm ready to do things. I can have conversations. I can interact with people. I am raring to go. I don't get depressed. I don't get sleepy. Well, maybe after a bucket. But I don't have that relationship or that physical reaction to alcohol. And that's what we call the allergy. Now, there have been a lot of studies on this, and this is not AA. This is scientific mumbo-jumbo, which I happen to agree with, but I'm not going to talk about it here because it's not in our literature. But there we have what Dr. Silkworth had suspected, that there was a physical difference between non-alcoholics and alcoholics, has come to be proven through scientific research. And the idea here is I metabolize alcohol differently than the non-alcoholic. That's a physical allergy. The mental obsession is the idea that I think that everybody drinks like me. I think that everybody has the same experience I have with alcohol. And eventually, when that delusion was taken from me, because after a certain point I realized that the people that I'm drinking with are not getting arrested, they're not breaking windows, they're not waking up in piles of their own vomit, they're not slicing their wrists, they're not doing these things, that they're drinking, having a good time, going home. Meanwhile, I'm lost in, you know, wandering around for days, you know, not knowing where I am. You know, I realized that I'm having a different experience than they're having. And ultimately, it came down to this one very core concept with me when it comes to the mental obsession, which is, I don't care. I don't care what's going to happen when I put alcohol in my body because I need it. I need it, and the consequences are irrelevant because the pain that I'm experiencing right here, right now, is worth whatever I'm going to pay for later. And that brings us to the spiritual malady, which produces that state. Now, the spiritual malady is that thing, whether I'm 10 years sober, 15 years sober, or 15 days sober, we all have it if you're an alcoholic. And that's the progressive part of our disease, because once you stop putting alcohol in your system, yeah, you know, you're, in the sense that your tolerance for alcohol and those things, that's progressive. You know, but as long as I don't put it into my system, I don't experience the consequences of that, right? Not so with the spiritual malady. The spiritual malady, or the spiritual sickness, the way that Bill talks about it in the big book, that's a progressive aspect of our disease that continues to grow as we stay sober. And I found that as I've stayed sober, the longer I'm sober, the more I have to work in certain ways because of this ego, this pride, this inferiority, being driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, and self-pity. I step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate, seemingly without provocation, but I find that sometime I made a decision based on self that placed me in a position to be hurt, that sort of stuff. Yeah, my sponsor made me read that over and over again for a couple years. Yeah, fun. But the truth is that's exactly what happens with me, is that I have a progressive spiritual illness that tells me that I'm unique. It tells me that I'm special. It tells me that I need more. I need now. And that somehow, in some way, I'm either insignificant or overly qualified for you all. And that progressive spiritual disease is what causes that pain that makes drink look like a good idea once I've been separated from alcohol for an extended period of time. Now, I've always been able to put down alcohol. I was never able to stay away from it. And that's probably because my disease hadn't progressed to the point that it had in certain other people, because I did get sober at 18. And I hear a lot of people talk about it, and they say things like, I wish I got sober at 18, you know. That's so great. You lived your whole adult life sober. And I'm like, yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. But, I mean, part of it was, you know, I didn't get sober because I was having a good time. And I think that's something that we forget when we're here long enough, was that, you know, that I wasn't having a good time. Alcohol was not solving my problems. I was lonely and afraid and devastated, and I had nothing and no one. I remember being 16 years old, and I attempted suicide. I had attempted suicide quite a few times, and I died for 2 minutes. And I woke up a couple days later in the ICU. And I remember hating God because he wouldn't take me. And for me, life was so incredibly painful with or without a drink that to die seemed like the only solution that I could muster at that point. And to know that I couldn't even die, that I could die, but I wasn't leaving this earth and I wasn't leaving the pain that I had felt prior to that incident, made me reject all concept of spiritual life because I felt like God didn't want me. And I felt like God made me an alcoholic. He made my family suck. He made all these terrible things happen to me. And then he won't even let me get out of it. And for me, from that point on, my relationship with God was very much about doing anything or anything that I could do that would break the rules. You know, I mean, it was all out war. And I rejected. It wasn't that I didn't believe there was a God. I just hated him. I hated God. And I didn't think God gave a crap about me. You know, so when you're in that state, you can't die, you can't drink, you can't not drink. And there's no way of functioning in society in any meaningful manner. What do you do? Well, I had been in and out of AA since I was 13 years old. I had said that several members of my family had darkened the doors of AA. I'm the only one who has stayed. So my parents were relatively familiar. They went to Al-Anon. They knew about rehab. They knew about that sort of stuff. So I would get carted off to rehab every couple months. It was like, oh, Carrie's crazy again. Let's send her to rehab. They'll fix her. You know, and I came out with a big book and a step book, and I'd have all my friends sign my big book. And, you know, three boyfriends. I went in there with a boyfriend. I came out with three more. It was great. I loved rehab. It was like Lord of the Flies, man, because I'm a teenager. Sent to rehab with other teenagers. All we did was bad things. Very, very bad things. And so for me, it was like kind of like Lord of the Flies. I looked forward to rehab. You know, they gave me drugs, prescribed, which, you know, wasn't booze, but whatever. I had ready access to teenage boys and no parents. Awesome. So, really. So, you know, I'd get shipped off to rehab, and I'd come out, and I'd be 10 times worse than when I went in, you know, because, there was no listening, there was no getting through to me. I'd sit in AA meetings, and there would be all old people, and I'd be like, you know what, you people, you have no idea what I'm experiencing, and you're old, and you know nothing, and I'm incredibly unique, and I got 10, 15 more years of drinking in me, thank you very much. So, you know, you can take your book, and you can put it where the sun don't shine, and don't let the door hit you on the ass on the way out. Thank you. You know, and that was really my attitude. So having experienced that form of AA, you know, and then being carted to meetings by my parents and dumped off and saying, you know, you need to get this signed because I had contracts and all the stuff they teach you and they teach the parents to do. And so they dumped me off in an AA meeting and I would run out the back and go to Newark and then come back in a couple hours, you know, and tell them I had a great time at the diner. Yeah. And I had a coffee commitment. I would take the money that they would give me for the coffee commitment and use it to buy booze. And yeah, I did all that stuff. So, I mean, my experience with AA was rehab. My experience with AA was, you know, young people's meetings, which I like to call liars and criers. 90 dances in 90 days. I thought, you know, I could date my way through young people's meetings, and eventually I'd find the right guy who would make my life all better. I did. I married him. You know, we've been married for 16 years, or 17 years. Oh, my God. 17 years. But, you know, that was actually a mistake that worked out really well for me. You know, he had, like, 3 days clean, and he was an ex-con who had just gotten out of prison, and he was 24, and I was 17. That looked like a really good idea. My Irish Catholic parents are going to love him. They do, by the way. They like him more than they like me. They really do. He chats with my mother. But, you know, so I mean, I'm giving you an idea of what I thought AA was, because in that experience, you know, between rehabs, young people's meetings, lying and crying and not taking this disease seriously, you know, it's no wonder that I couldn't stay sober. But part of it was that nobody told me. And maybe they were telling me and I couldn't hear because of how blocked I was. But where I got sober, I mean, the steps were not something you actually worked. They were things that you thought about. You know, you read the 12 and 12 and you thought about what you would do when you made amends one day. You know, I remember my sponsor gave me I said I wouldn't believe in God, so she gave me this really big, beautiful amethyst rock, which then I got drunk and left it at my parents' house, and my mom threw it out. So the question is like, was that really a higher power if my mom could, like, throw it in the garbage? You know, so, like, they meant well, but they really didn't have a message that had depth and weight for somebody like me. And maybe they were able to, for whatever reason, stay sober, but I couldn't. So what eventually happened was not only did I lose faith in God, but I lost faith that AA could work for me. Hence the suicide attempt, hence dying, waking up, not being dead, being really pissed about that and nowhere to go. And so I drank for another 2 years. And I met my husband. I moved in with him in like a week. I was already living. See, I had this thing, and the women will identify with this, and I don't care about talking this from the podium because I'm not that woman anymore, but I had this thing where, like, if you had a wallet and you were a dirty old man, you were so mine. You got to think about it. Like, I'm not legal to buy booze. I have no actual money nor any skills to get money. And I wasn't necessarily going to go out in the corner because I didn't have to. All I had to do was go, I'm jailbait. Can I move in? It worked very well for me for a long time. And it was funny because I was living with another jailbait guy who had two ex-wives, a couple kids, and I'm 17. And I meet my husband, and I fall madly in stupidity with him. I move in with him in a week, and we go out and drink. And the reason why I talk about this, and this for me was the thing that taught me the true nature of alcoholism. I went out to drink, and I had a little bit of time sober. You know, a little over a year, I was abstinent from alcohol, but I wasn't abstinent from non-conference-approved substances, if you get my drift. And I went out and I said, I'm just going to drink this one night, and I'm going to go right back to AA tomorrow. And I had, at certain points, been able to do that. Go out for a couple nights, come back to AA, let you guys, like, patch me up, lick my wounds, find some stupid, dirty old man, move in with him, you know, and start the cycle all over again. And what had happened was I had every intention of coming back to AA, and I couldn't. I couldn't stop drinking. And I would get up in the morning, and I would say, I'm going to go to a meeting today. I'm going to go. And I would walk. And I would leave my house to walk to a meeting, and I'd be drunk before I got there. And I would beg God. I was like, God, please help me to just go back to AA. Please help me to go back to AA. And I couldn't stop drinking. And for me, I had never really wanted AA. I had never really wanted God. I was angry and indignant and a brat. And then when I had hit a point in my drinking where I was completely, utterly hopeless, and all I wanted to do was stop, I couldn't. And for me, that was such a scary, scary thing, to be 18 years old and drinking every day, and I can't stop. I can't even pause it. I just can't stop. And I remember my husband, at a certain point, he had some friends from AA who called him and wanted to go to, like, a barbecue or something. And I knew that if he went out and hung out with these people, sobriety is, like, contagious, right? He was going to stop drinking. And he couldn't stop drinking because I'm not going to stop drinking. I can't stop drinking. So I locked myself in the bathroom and cried and carried on until he promised to come home and drink with me after he was done, which I have since made amends for, by the way. So this is what it looks like for me, and this is what it looks like to be an alcoholic. And it says in the big book, the most ardent desire or wish is of no avail. That's the nature of powerlessness for me in my experience, is wanting to stop drinking desperately and not being able to. And the idea, and I don't know why I stopped on September 6th. I don't know why I woke up that morning and the power was in me to be able to go to an AA meeting. I don't know why, because it doesn't make any sense to me. I had wanted it, and I had tried it every day for 4 months, and I couldn't stop. And that day, for whatever reason, I woke up. I was sleeping in somebody's basement because I was homeless at this point. I packed my garbage bag, which I carried around with me, with all my worldly possessions, and I was able to walk to that AA meeting without getting drunk. And I went to another one. And I stayed in AA like that for 2 years with no recovery, no real step work, no real God, just hanging on. And after about 2 years of being sober, all I wanted to do was die again, because that's the progressive spiritual illness that I talked about, that God graced me with the ability to not drink. And part of it was, and I really believe this, is for the first 2 years or the first year and a half of my recovery, I had gotten pregnant in detox, actually. I was detoxing, I'm pretty sure, when I got pregnant with my daughter. So I found out that I was pregnant when I was about 60 days sober. And for the first year and a half to 2 years, my daughter was my higher power. She was my only reason to even show up and come to AA. The only power that I can conceive of that was a power greater than myself. The problem was that didn't fix the spiritual sickness within me. It didn't fix the selfishness. It didn't fix the fear. All it did was keep me away from alcohol. And the selfishness, the dishonesty, the resentment, and the fear that was within me was the thing that was pushing me back to it. So after about 2 years sober, I didn't want to drink. I just wanted to die. And all I could do was look at my daughter, who was about a little over a year old, and think, she's not going to have a mother anymore. I can't be her mother. And in some bizarre twist, I walked into a meeting in Staten Island, and there was this guy there. He was from California, and he was on his way to go study with the Dalai Lama. And he was in this meeting. And mind you, I'm a brat. I'm a punk rock chick. I carried around knives. I'm covered in I'm covered in tattoos. I had green, purple, pink, orange hair. You know, if my head wasn't shaved, you know, so I was really attractive, you know. So I'm sitting in this meeting, and there's this guy. He looks like if David Crosby had sex with Captain Kangaroo and they had a love child, this is what this guy looks like. And I'm an utter brat. So I'm sitting in this meeting, and this guy's talking about the 9-step. And I'm listening to him talk about making the amends. You have to make all the amends. You have to do this. You have to do that. And I walked right up to him, and I'm like, how dare you say that? They harm me more than I harm them. They don't deserve my effing bleeping bleeping bleep 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 amends. They should be graveling on my feet. They made me this sick. And he just laughed. I mean, he really just was like, oh, I have you. And he gave me that smile that I give people that I hate now. I hated them, and they hate. And I get that smile like, I have got you. And he said to me, he's like, well, he asked me these questions, those things that I just talked about. What does it mean to be an alcoholic? He asked me questions about that. He qualified me. That's something, no one had ever done that before. No one had ever asked me, you know, do you think you're an alcoholic? They assume because I parked my stupid butt in the chair I was. Well, guess what? Not everybody who parks their butt in a chair in Alcoholics Anonymous is an alcoholic. And it's my job as a member of AA to talk to them and say, gee, do you got these symptoms? No? Okay, well, you know, how does that express itself? Oh, you know, you're a cocaine addict. Guess what? We got a fellowship for you. I'm going to take you there. Because not everybody who comes to AA is an alcoholic. And that was something that I learned. And this is something that this guy taught me. And so he qualified me as to what it means to be an alcoholic. And when I answered the questions, I guess, appropriately, he pulled somebody over and he said, "Hips, you're going to do step work with this guy." And it was a guy. And I hated men. They were wallets and private parts, and they had no other use. And now I have to, this guy's going to save my life, teach me this book? No. No way. But I was dying, and I was afraid, and I knew that I had to do something. So I was like, all right, okay, I'll do it a little bit, but if he gets weird, I'm out of here. And I had started to begin to have an experience with the 12 steps. And since then, I've been graced with many wonderful sponsors and wonderful experiences. I mean, I'm probably one of the luckiest women in Alcoholics Anonymous because I've had such wonderful teachers. You know, and it's not because of me. It's actually because my husband is really awesome, and he always has the awesome sponsors. And I can go up to them and be like, hey, can I have that paperwork too? You know, oh, you're doing that? Let me ask you about it. And so then, you know, by virtue of having my husband get sober with me and him having wonderful sponsors and me having wonderful women sponsors, I got the best of both worlds. I got to pick my husband's brains, pick his sponsor's brains, and pick my sponsor's brains. I was a complete and utter AA slut. If you had recovery, you had a process, and you had something that was going on, I was going to be in your corner, sitting on your lap, begging you for the answers. And it worked for me. You know, and the idea was that I was very lucky that I've had some wonderful teachers. And I don't mean to sound, you know, blasé about it. I mean, I'm very grateful for the people that God put in my life. This one man I met years later, and to be able to tell him that a 10-minute conversation he had with me is the reason why I'm standing here today was a beautiful thing. And he had no idea. I was a blip on his screen, and he changed my life. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about God's universe and the way that God works, is we have no idea the impact that we have on other people. I have no idea. If I knew, I'd be an arrogant SOB. So the great thing is I don't know. I get to walk through this world putting my shoes on, you know, 1 foot at a time and show up. And the fact that I get to help somebody without even realizing that I did or without realizing the impact of something that I might have said had on them is a beautiful thing. It's greater than any high that I've ever gotten while I was an active alcoholic. So I began to have an experience with the steps. I learned what it meant to be an alcoholic. And that brings us to that wonderful point in the second step where the question is you know what you are, but what are you going to do about it? That's really the question of the second step. Is now that you know what you are, we have two choices. We can die an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis. What are you going to do? I can continue to blot out the intolerableness of my situation. And I can do that in a lot of ways. I can do that with men. I can do that with food, exercise, money, designer jeans. I got a lot of things that I can blot out the intolerableness of my situation. Or I can accept spiritual help. But that spiritual help has conditions. It means that I have to follow direction. It means that I have to start listening to something other than my own brain. Because ultimately it comes down to this thing, is that my thinking owns me. My mind wears me like a hat. And the things that I think are completely insane. They're insane and demented. I mean, the big book says that we were warped and sickened. Bill doesn't really, when the writers of the big book wrote this stuff down, they were not like soft-selling it in the least. He said warped and sickened, spiritually sick, you know, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, and self-pity. I mean, like, really, that's pretty clear that I'm not a well cat. There'd be something wrong with me, you know. And the idea here is that, and I love this, and it says this in Weak Gnosticism, it says that the God idea works, our ideas don't. And I think for me, out of all the aspects of, or when we look at the second step and we really look at it, you know, we come to two conclusions. One, that I either accept that I have this disease or I don't, and I'm willing to accept spiritual help. And accepting spiritual help means that my ideas don't work and the God idea does. It's a natural progression of that. I mean, there's a lot more to it, but ultimately, my whole life hinges on what I'm going to answer in those questions. Because the fact is I lack the power to be able to put into action the things that I think or know to be right. See, ultimately, it comes down to this thing, is that I lack the power to live a life that I know I should be living. I could know that I'm not supposed to lie, cheat, and steal. I could know that I'm supposed to be a good person. I could know that I'm supposed to be of service to God and others. But I lack the ability to do that because of my own spiritual sickness, because I'm blocked from that power. And it's that blocked, that clog in those arteries that give me that spiritual heart attack, that bring me back to booze, because it makes booze look like a good idea. Because the pain that I'm experiencing in the present is greater than the future pain that might be out there possibly if I pick up that drink. So ultimately, it comes down to how am I going to get access to that power? How does that happen? Well, the steps are the whole intent of the Big Book and the 12 steps and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has enabled me to get access to that power. Ultimately, it's a matter of waking up to realize that that power is present here, right now, I'm just too dumb to notice it. You know, because the fact is, if God is everything, right? I either accept God is everything, God is no thing. Ultimately, it comes down to this thing: is that if God is a part of everything that I do and involved in every aspect of my life, then it's not a matter of getting in touch with God or finding God, but waking up to realize that God has been here all along and I've just been blind. Blinded by my own self-will and my own designs and demands that I put on the world and myself. I had an idea of what my life was supposed to look like and who I was supposed to be. And I was very upset that I didn't live up to those ideals. Well, for one thing, I wanted to be 6 foot tall blonde with really big boobs. I'm a short, dark Irish woman. It was a cruel joke. I wanted to be really smart. See, I'm smart enough to know that I'm not that smart. I wanted to be, like, crazy smart. Like, I wanted to be, like, Good Will Hunting smart. I killed too many brain cells for that. I really don't think I had the potential to be that smart anyway. But I like to think that maybe it was just the brain cell dying that caused that. You know, so there are things, these grandiose ideas that I had about who I should be. I should be beautiful, and I should be intelligent. I should be graceful at all times. By the way, I'm an absolute klutz, and I am completely socially awkward. So much so, it's ridiculous. And the beautiful thing is God has such a great sense of humor that I'm completely socially awkward, but then I'm invited to speak at conferences all over the world and stuff, and I have to talk to people that I don't know, and I just want to hide under my chair. It's fun. God has a sense of humor about that sort of stuff. God bless him. So I have all these things, and I have this idea of who I should be, and I have this person that I am. And the thing is I was very angry at myself and God for not letting me be what I thought I should be. And then when I got sober and I started to work these steps, and I realized I had all these unrealistic expectations and demands on you and on me. And ultimately what it was is I expected you all to give me my self-esteem. I expected you all to provide me with a sense of pride. I expected you all to give me emotional security, to fulfill my ambitions, to provide me with money, and all the men should worship me, and the women should be jealous of me at all times. You know, and I expected that this should happen. And if you failed to do any of those things, well, I got angry, right? I got resentful. You know, because I had unrealistic expectations of what God's world was supposed to look like and who Carrie was supposed to look like in God's world. And it came down to this idea that my ideas about life did not work, and God's ideas do. So how do I access the vision of what God's will is for me and be able to live that on a daily basis? Well, it comes down to this, you know, we look at, then that brings us to the third step. And the third step is simply a decision for me to seek this experience with God and myself. Because when it comes down to it, sponsors, AA, home group, all of those things aside, it's the relationship between myself and my higher power and alcohol that decide what my life looks like. It's the sponsor, the friend, the home group, the fellowship, the commitments that we take that create the environment that allow that relationship to grow. But ultimately, when you strip all of that away, it's about what I believe about myself, about God's universe, and about alcohol that allow me to live successfully. So I had to take a look at these things. And ultimately, it came down to this idea that I had to make a pact with God. Do you ever really look at the third step prayer? The third step prayer is a contract, man. Look at it. You know, we ask God, we say, you know, God, I want to be in your, I want you to create with me and do with me as thou will, right? Well, when I'm an active alcoholic and when I'm running on self-will or I'm an untreated alcoholic, I'm not a part of God's creation. I'm creating the world in my own image, right? And I'm saying, you guys should be the way I think you should be so that I don't have to be uncomfortable. Because you all should make me comfortable at all times, and I should never feel ookie, ever. So I'm creating the world in my image. So when I take that third step prayer, when I get down on my knees with my sponsees, when I say this prayer every day, what I'm saying to God is I want to be a part of His creation, and I'm going to stop dictating what creation looks like, right? I ask God to take away my difficulties. What are my difficulties? Well, myself, for one of them. I ask God to take away my difficulties, that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help of thy love, thy power, and thy way of life. So I'm saying all these difficulties, these are the difficulties that we see in our fourth step and that we talk about in our fifth step and we make amends for in our ninth step. These are the difficulties that are standing in my way of me being useful to God and others. I ask God to take away them, but I ask Him to take away them not for my own comfort, but so that I can be a vision of what God's will is for me and others, so I can be an example of what spiritual healing looks like. I'm not asking God to heal me for my comfort. I'm asking God to heal me for yours. I ask to be relieved of the bondage of self. And again, so that I can better do His will. I'm not asked to be relieved of the bondage of self so that Carrie can be comfortable in her life. Guess what? Being of service sucks sometimes. And it's really uncomfortable. Wakes you up in the middle of the night. People throw up on you. They steal your stuff. I mean, I just had my wedding ring and my engagement ring, you know, stolen a couple months ago, you know, by an alcoholic that we were helping. God bless him. I really hope that that bottle was worth it, and I love him, and if he wants to get sober, he's welcome back in my house. I'm just going to lock up my jewelry, man. It was just stuff. But here's the deal. Being of service sometimes can be a pain in the hiney. The whole point of me asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self is not so that I can be comfortable, it's so that I can be of service to God, because I've been of service to myself, my emotions, my thoughts, and I've worshipped my mind. And I've let my mind wear me like a hat. And what I make a contract with God to fix that, but my deal is I got to serve Him. And I got to serve Him in the way that it looks good, it looks to Him, not to me. Because I serve you in a way that makes me look good, so I can always be important and special, because that's what I really want. I want to be a superstar in AA. And my sponsor used to tell me all the time, he used to say, "You're the only person who wants to be a somebody in a program full of nobodies. What does that make you?" I was like, good point. That's like, I want to be the king of the land of the broken toys, you know? You know, that's the alcoholic ego, right? We want to be important. Hey, I'm going to serve in the big broad strokes. But then when the alcoholic who just calls and wants to have a conversation, I'm too damn busy for that, because I got to watch TV and paint my nails. No. I serve God in the way that He tells me that I need to serve and what it looks like for Him. So we make this contract with God. And then we make that decision to seek that solution, to seek that relief. And part of that is through 4 through 9. And 4 through 9 in itself is such a crazy adventure. I mean, I don't know how many times I've been through the steps. I mean, I'll be sober 17 years next month, God willing. And I've been through the steps at least once a year since I was 2 years sober. And there were a couple of years where I kind of worked the steps until my fingers bled, because I thought, like, if I wrote the perfect 4-step, I'd be the perfect AA and I'd never have any problems. Yeah, that didn't work. So I wrote, like, maybe, like, 4 or 5 4-steps for a couple of years, a year. My husband was like, "Damn it, please, stop writing inventory." He's like, "Stop writing inventory." He's like, just put the pen away. I'm like, "No, I have a new fear I need to look at." He's like, "Oh, my God." Poor man. So he suffered through that. God bless him. So I've worked the steps. I've been through the steps. I'm going to conservatively say at least 20 times in the past, 16 years. So every time I've gone back through it, I've had a new experience with it. And, four through nine is an incredible thing, because it's about waking up. It's about seeing things about myself that maybe I didn't see before. I mean, I got the broad strokes that I somehow couldn't figure out how to live. And I got the thing that people really didn't like me. It might have been like, I might have realized that when I was, on the corner in the middle of East Orange, which for Pennsylvania people, it's like, the hood, very much the hood. And I'm standing on the corner barefoot in like a Grateful Dead t-shirt. And I don't even know if I had shorts on. I might have had shorts, or might have just been a really long shirt, jumping up and down. You need to do that. I need to drink dance. I need to drink. I'm waiting for someone to come back with my bottle. And I'm going to sit in the corner. And my mother, she's driving home from work, and she stops at a light and she sees me standing there. I'm 18 years old, maybe like 18 by like 2 months. And she sees me standing there jiggling on the corner. And she looks at me. And she looks away. And she kept driving. She couldn't stop, because that would break her heart one more time. She just couldn't stop. So when I looked at 4 through 9 and I really looked at the things that I had done in my life and the way that I was living, I had a delusion that somehow my alcoholism was causal, and that, the things, the selfishness and the dishonesty that I had, maybe I had them, but somehow they were somebody else's fault. And what I came to understand through this process was that I don't know why I have that spiritual God, I have that God-shaped hole. I don't know why I'm incredibly selfish and dishonest in my core. I don't know why I'm driven by fear. I don't know why those things exist, but they do. And the stories that I told myself about why I behaved the way I did were often quite inaccurate. Now, mind you, I'm one of those people, and I don't like talking about this from the podium, but I think there's enough women here for me to feel comfortable doing this. Sorry, guys. But I, you know, when you're an alcoholic and you're a woman and you're drinking, some bad things happen to you, man. I mean, in fact, when I'm fist-stepping somebody and they don't have a rape, I'm like, are you sure? Really? You're not repressing anything? And they're like, no, no, no. I'm like, oh, my God. Crap, you're the exception. I mean, we experience, alcoholic women experience a level of degradation that I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand. And we bring in a lot of guilt and a lot of pain and a lot of horror that we experience when we're drinking. And, yeah, we made decisions based on self, the places and the position we hurt, but ultimately we're carrying a hell of a lot of psychic pain. And we come into AA. I came into AA with all of this pain. I came into AA as a kid who had been thrown downstairs, had been beaten and abused and raped and tortured. And I came into AA having experienced all of that, believing that the steps could not fix me. You know, I had some of the best psychiatrists. I've been in some of the nicest psychiatric hospitals and rehabs during my, yeah, some of the best ones. I was in the same psychiatric hospital that Karen Carpenter had been in. You know, my parents had Cadillac insurance. I'm probably part of the reason why people don't have good insurance anymore and coverages for rehabs because I went so many times. But the thing was, is that I had the best doctors in the world. I had a shrink who would drive the streets looking for me when I was, you know, off doing what I was doing. She would drive in her Mercedes around East Orange looking for me, you know, in the hood. And of course, I had Dodger and stuff, but I mean, I had a shrink that cared enough to drive on her own time and risk her car, you know, looking for me, you know. And I thought there's no way that the four through nine could fix this pain. And I'm here to tell you, it absolutely can. It has knitted me back together in a way that I cannot describe. In fact, I am so much not the person that I was when I walked into these rooms. When I blamed my mom a lot for the pain that I experienced because I felt that she should have protected me from some of the bad things that happened to me in my household. And I had tried to make amends to her a handful of times, you know, without, you know, ever making amends that's just kind of like an aborted amends. You made it, but the problem was still there and there wasn't real healing. You just said the words. Ever have an amend like that? Maybe you guys aren't as sick as me. But I kept making amends to her, and I would come back, and I would come back through inventory, and I'd find that I was still resentful towards her, and I couldn't figure out how I can get through this resentment. And I had a sponsor at the time who had a daughter who was my age who was in AA. So she had done all the things that my mom had done, and her daughter and I were friends. And she helped me to see my resentments from my mother's perspective, which I had never considered to entertain. Because she deserved all the anger and resentment I had towards her because she failed me, don't you know? And when my sponsor helped me to see it from her perspective, I began to have compassion for my mother. And when I was about 5 years sober, I went to make an amends to her. And the one thing that I always wanted from my mother was for her to say that she was sorry, to acknowledge what had happened to me in my childhood, which was pretty damn bad. And, you know, you have a bunch of alcoholics in a household, throw them all together and have them fist fight. I'm like, I'm actually 16 years younger than my oldest sister, so I was like a little kid. So a lot of times fist fights would happen, and I would be in the middle of them as a little child. And it was extremely painful, and it was horrible. And I had a lot of violence, and I blamed her for that because I felt that she was my mother and she didn't protect me. And when I went to make an amends to her, for the first time I approached her, I didn't expect that she should be any way. I just wanted to heal and have a relationship with her that was relatively functional. And so I went and I said all the same things I had said before. And something happened. She heard it for the first time. For 5 years I had been trying to heal this relationship, but I had always had secret demands on her that she be different. I wanted a different mother. I wanted Carol Brady. I didn't want my mother. I wanted her to be somebody different. She didn't love me in the way that I thought she should have because I expected love to come in the package that I wanted it to. And if you failed to provide it that way, then I was going to punish you. And when I approached her with the compassion for her situation, having, you know, four alcoholic children beating the crap out of one another in the household. You know, having compassion for the guilt that she must feel for the life that I experienced. She said the one thing that I always wanted her to say to me, which was, I'm sorry that you had a bad childhood. That's all she could say. And it was enough. But she would never say it while she knew that I judged her. Because no one is ever going to open themselves up to listen to what you have to say if you're pointing a finger at them. I didn't know how not to do that. It took 5 years and working the steps, like, well, 3 years, because I 2 years I spent lying and crying. 2 years, or 3 years, something like that, working the steps until my fingers bled for me to be able to get to a point where I could approach that amend with real healing, and it happened. And I tell you what, I haven't had a crossword with my mother in, it's going to be 12 years, man. You know? And that's the healing that goes on here. You know, this is the real deal that we experience, that I've experienced, that not only could I come to Alcoholics Anonymous with just plain old alcoholism, but I can come to Alcoholics Anonymous crazy as a shithouse rat and get better. And for me, that's an incredible miracle that I can show up to life and people don't look at me and say, gee, there's something a little off about her, but she's a nice girl. They see me in a way that I completely cannot see myself. Because they see me as Carrie. Not as Carrie the alcoholic. Not as Carrie the poor little girl. Not as Carrie the inmate at the insane asylum. Not as any of those things. They see me as Carrie. And that has probably got to be one of the greatest gifts that God in this program has ever given me. To allow me to be a human being without any labels. That I can show up to life and just be. And not have to be anything other than exactly what I am. A foul-mouthed hooligan, a mother of four, you know, an office manager from hell, a mean sponsor, and a decent wife. These are all things that I can be because of being here. So when I see people, and I didn't even get into 10, 11, and 12, and I'm sorry about that because I got a whole lot to say on that. But I'm going to talk about 12 in the last 4 minutes that I got. Is when I see people in AA, when I see people stay around for, you know, 10 years, 8 years, 9 years, and then they get busy with their life. And this is especially, this is going back to the women, because men tend to not do this like women do. We get real busy, and then we forget about AA. Never do that? Never have those periods of time where, like, you know, you find yourself, like, not sponsoring and turning people down because you're real, real busy? I find that that happens a lot amongst the women. And here's the thing, is that there are not a lot of women out there with a real, real solution to alcoholism. There are not a lot of women out there with years' experience of working the steps under their belt. So we get a handful of years sober, we're living on a spiritual basis, we're flying, we're having a great life, so what do? We hide it and keep it to ourselves. We hide in our homes, we live our life, we do our thing, we cook our pies, we make our apple pies, we hang out, do our nails, we get tanned, we get waxed, we get the Brazilian wax, we do all that shit. But God forbid we pick up a phone and talk to a newcomer. Or stay involved in our home group. You know, and that's one of the most selfish things that I've seen in Alcoholics Anonymous. The most selfish thing that I can see that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is when our spirit wakes up and we decide to take our ball and go home because we're fine. While people are out there dying. Dying. People like me have to sponsor 10, 15 people at a time because people won't be bothered to pick up the phone for the newcomer. And they say things like, oh, don't show, that person's drunk, don't talk to them. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, man. If I got turned away from AA every time I showed up here drunk, I wouldn't have come back. And then somebody shows up drunk in a meeting and everybody's like, ooh, they stink. Well, of course they stink, so did you. So spray him with some Glade, give him a freaking big book, and talk to him in the parking lot. And this is what this is all about. And I don't mean, I'm sorry, I'm a foul-mouthed hooligan, and I apologize for my colorful language. It's a character defect. I apologize for it. But the fact is, it's something that I believe thoroughly. So the idea is that we need to stay on the firing line of life. We need to stay on the firing line. And that's why I love that I got invited to speak here, because I know I'm speaking I am preaching to the choir, and I know you people are doing this. And I love that. I absolutely love that. I love that there's a group here, and it's bigger than, well, actually, you guys are pretty small tonight. Haha, I didn't draw that much of a crowd. I'm kidding. I hear you're a real big group. And people come from all over. And that's amazing, because this is what we need to be doing. We need to stay active and stay kicking butt in AA. Because, yeah, God gives us beautiful things in our lives. Wonderful. They're mitzvahs. But the fact is I drew a sober breath today because somebody put their hand out to me. My 12th step is somebody else's first step. And their first step is my 12th step. And if I'm too lazy to show up for God in AA and fulfill that contract I made in the third step and that I reaffirmed in the second, seventh step, then I should just go and take my ball and go home and drink, because that's what I'm going to do anyway, eventually. So ultimately, I have a responsibility to God and AA to be here today and be of service to God and others. And that means doing the uncomfortable things, like answering the phone when I got to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I got to drive an hour home, hour and a half home, and get up at 4:30 in the morning to go to work and drive an hour and a half to Jersey tomorrow. It's a privilege to be here and to serve God. It's a privilege to do this. And if I don't get a whole lot of sleep, so what? It's an honor to be of service to the program that has given me back me. Thank you so much.